You're listening to Carving Space, an Indigenous Radio Doc series.
We are broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, unceded, and current lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. We are really grateful and privileged to be here on these lands, studying at a colonial institution that allows CITR to do the work that we do. Vangwizi, Autumn Chanel Vilji, Chief Jim Cooey, Janet Cooey, Jacqueline Cooey, Vivian Cooey, Shadeji. My name is Autumn Chanel. I am a member of Gwich'in First Nation. I was born and raised in Amaskwachi, Waskayagan, traditional lands of the Cree, Métis, Nakota Sioux, and Soto peoples. I'm really lucky and grateful to be studying here on Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh lands.
My names are Rachel Lau and Lauhole. I'm a Han Chinese settler who was born and raised on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations. I'm incredibly privileged and grateful as a settler to be able to live and work on these lands. As coordinators of this doc series, we had the pleasure of working with Indigenous and non-Indigenous students here at the University of British Columbia.
This project is funded by the Equity Enhancement Fund and created in collaboration with the UBC First Nations and Indigenous Studies Program and the Institute for Critical Indigenous Studies.
We produce these docs with the intention of centering Indigenous perspectives on feminism, poetry, student life, and health and wellness.
You might be listening to these docs on Stitcher, iTunes, CITR.ca, or live on CITR 101.9 FM. Docs from the Carving Space series will be released every Monday until May 14th.
For more info on the docs and the series, visit citr.ca.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people and around the world at CITR.ca. Vangwizi, Autumn Chanel Vilji, Chief Jim Cooey, Janet Cooey, Shadeji, Jacqueline Cooey, Shadeji. My name is Autumn Chanel. I am Treaty 11 Gwich'in and a Nuvialuit on my mother's side, and I am of settler German descent on my father's side. For this radio documentary, we are going to be exploring Indigenous feminisms and what that means not only to me, but as to most Indigenous, queer, two-spirit bodies that are navigating this space. So I would say this project for me started about over a year ago now, when one of my high school teachers told me that Indigenous feminism didn't exist. So I would say that's where the praxis of this project came from. And that really challenged me. It kind of challenged who I was as a human being, the devotion that I had to feminism, what I wanted and thought that I knew, and how I thought I was going to say it. Yeah, so the definition for me, I would say I started just by Googling feminism. This definition was not enough. It was missing something. There were holes in it. First of all, it uses the word sexes, which is inherently problematic. But it also kind of didn't encapsulate the nuance that I had associated with feminism previously. It didn't account for Indigenous feminism, which is what we're going to be discussing, but it didn't really account for ableism. It didn't really account for like Marxist feminism. It didn't account for any of the waves. It didn't really account for any of the nuance that I associated with feminism previously. My own personal research started with that, and it continued on with my interview with Crystal Fraser, which I will be airing later. And my interview with Crystal Fraser really changed the way I saw feminism. She articulated the way that I saw the nuance of feminism, kind of debunked hegemonic settler sexualities, debunked hegemonic settler genderisms, all of the above. And so that changed the way I saw things. And then my research continued when I took FNIS, or First Nations and Indigenous Studies 100, here with Dr. Dori Nathan, who I then decided to interview for this radio documentary later. This was one of my interests, I would say, coming into this. And my experience with Dr. Dori Nathan was really lovely. She kind of talked about the history of feminism, where feminism exists now, where it started, the process of getting from where it started to where it is now. She talked about Zikala Shah, which I thought was really, really interesting. It was a great experience. experience. So these are two really strong, empowered women, Crystal Fraser being Dinjisu or Treaty 11 Gwich'in, which is my homeland. And then it continued on with Dr. Dori Nason, who is Anishinaabe and Chicana. So yeah, the first interview that we're going to be hearing is by Dr. Dori Nason, and we're going to be hearing and listening to what she has to say about feminism within the literary world and her own experiences, her problems, her challenges with feminism. So enjoy.
My name is Dori Nason. I'm a professor in First Nation Studies and the Department of English. My pronouns are she and her. I'm an Indigenous feminist, a scholar, a writer, and mostly I think about myself as an Anishinaabe woman and also a Chicana woman.
Do you consider yourself a feminist when you were younger? Like I remember my feminist origins was when I was like 12 and I was like, yeah, equality.
I think I always had... my mom tells this story about me being 5 years old in the car and telling her that, you know, one, that I was going to be a professor, which I don't know how I heard of that.
Predicted.
I know. I'm like, I don't know how I came up with that. And that also that I found it really unfair that the way that girls were treated in the world. And, you know, I was never going to get married or change my name or do anything like that. And she was like, where is she getting all this stuff? So I think it was always, you know, kind of, I don't know where that came from, but I do know as a, you know, I had lots of strong women in my family. I think a lot of people say that who were also, I think I witnessed their mistreatment and the things that happened to them within family dynamics. And I think that was my justice orientation, was to want to deal with, quite frankly, intimate violence, domestic violence within seeing that growing up. So.
That's really interesting. And then can you tell us what Indigenous feminism means to you? I know it's a very broad question.
Okay, so what does it mean to me? For me, as I said, my kind of academic journey and personal journey was intertwined around thinking about why forms of gender violence were so pervasive, whether it was overt violence that was, you know, physical or sexual assault, or just the like everyday violences that you experience as a woman, and thinking about wanting that to change and be different and have people feel safe in their bodies or gender identity. And academically, you know, searching that out, trying to figure out like what is Indigenous feminism was actually kind of something that I'm still kind of thinking about. And as I said before, I don't like to define it because I think it always has to be attended to on the ground issues. And so it's going to look different at any given context, even for me in my own life. So right now I have a sense of it as a professor and an academic that Indigenous feminism is this kind of scholarship that's looking at these issues of violence and gender violence. But in terms of activists or personal experience, you know, it's a justice issue. And again, it's still kind of wrapped up in thinking about, you know, wanting the women that I know and love to be safe and to be accepted in any way they express themselves.
Yeah. And then can you tell us a little bit about your research?
My research, I'm like laughing at all this stuff. My research is varied. And I think if you look at my little blurb on the FNIS website, it says something about Native women's intellectual traditions. And I think originally that was kind of my focus because I really wanted to excavate what are Native women's critiques of gendered colonialism. And that's outside of even the ways that we think about a feminist historiography or frame. So I'm really interested in early writers like Zakala Shaw or women who are writing at the, you know, in the 1800s or the turn of the, or in the 20th century, at the turn of the 20th century, for, you know, finding those kernels and stories of their experience and the ways that they understood colonialism to be gendered in a particular way towards them. So that's one part of it, and that's a more of a historical project. The other part of it is really just the more contemporary and fun stuff that I like to think about and write about and look for are the ways that different forms of art making are attempting these same kinds of critiques. And so thinking about media artists or you know, visual artist, which I'm so not trained in, but I've become so excited about the ways that people like filmmakers like Maya Telfeathers or others are producing work that is so sophisticated in its critique and analysis that I see my research as holding those people up. So yeah. I often think of myself as a bit of a fraud because I'm like, I don't really do anything cool. I just point out cool people doing cool stuff.
Which is cool because not that most people don't do that. How are people ever going to find out about cool people doing cool things?
Yeah, well, like, I hope that's a good contribution. But but yeah, that's kind of the way I think about my research. So thinking about feminist art and practice, either contemporarily or finding these early voices that, you know, offered a critique.
How do you assist your students in learning about this subject?
That's a good question. Well, I have various opportunities either at the graduate level or the undergraduate level. You are in my introductory course in Native Studies or Indigenous Studies. And I also teach an Indigenous Feminism's fourth year seminar, which I'm doing right now. And so for different contexts, obviously, the approach changes. I do think Indigenous feminist scholarship and analysis at this point in time in critical Indigenous studies is one of the pillars of what we think about in terms of critical Indigenous studies. So I try to put that forward in the lower division courses. But in terms of thinking about Indigenous feminism in the upper division courses, I do try to think about how do we open up space for various people's engagement with the idea. And, you know, trying to make it as inclusive as possible, as I said, so that I don't create, one, a definition that everyone should follow, and two, to show that there's a wide range of diversity around the ways people think about this. So, you know, thinking about it outside of academic contexts, thinking about Jessica Yee's book, I'm going to get the title, that is, Feminism for Real, where she's kind of, she has a group of people write about, you know, when we think about Indigenous feminism, it's not necessarily happening in academic institutions, it's happening on the ground and in other spaces that are much more complicated about it and offer a different point of view. So I try to give a wide range of approaches.
And then can you tell us why Indigenous feminism is a crucial part of Indigenous studies, from your opinion at
from
least?
My opinion? Well, because I want to make space for myself. No,
because I want to speak.
As I want to speak. No, I think because, and I think Audra Simpson talks about this really well, as does Leanne Simpson. When we think about colonization, you can't afford to not have a gendered analysis of that. And whether you call it Indigenous feminism or not, if you call it something else, that's fine with me. But I think we understand colonialism to be something that still shapes our lives today. And when you have epidemics of violence against Indigenous women and I don't know how else you could approach thinking about settler colonialism any other way than to think about how gender impacts that, how sexuality impacts that, all sorts of things that were brought to us in categories that meant to harm us more than help us.
So what are some of your favorite Indigenous authors?
Indigenous authors?
Who do work around Indigenous feminism or even not work around Indigenous feminism?
I'm a literature professor. I'm going to pick my favorite author. Well, the people that I teach and write about often obviously Leanne Simpson. You can't not think about one of the most critical voices on colonialism today is her work, and students love her work when I do teach it. She's such an interesting scholar and thinker who, you know, does her academic writing is really important and strong, but the creative work that she does is also just really beautiful and hard-hitting and smart.
Yeah.
I also, in terms of like writers that I, storytellers that I read, outside of that, I really love this woman, Chickasaw writer Linda Hogan, who is maybe not so well known here in Canada, but for me, she's the person that tells the most Indigenous feminist stories that we need to hear. And so I often teach a book of hers called Solar Storms, which is about the James Bay Cree resistance to the Hydro-Québec Great Whale Project in the 70s. So, you know, even though she's an American writer, she focuses that book on a Canadian resistance movement that was really important and still really important today to, you know, thinking about extractivist industries and how they're tied up in this whole mess of gendered colonialism.
next interview that we are going to be listening to is by Crystal Fraser. I first met Crystal, I would say, over a year ago now. My brother and I were in Inuvik, and Crystal was flown up for the conference that we were attending, and we kind of met and got introductions, and she seemed like a really strong person. So I thought that she'd be the perfect person for me to interview for my radio show. So enjoy.
Dringwinzi. My name is Crystal Fraser. I am Gwichia Gwichin, originally from Inuvik and Tree River in the Northwest Territories.
Great. So tell me a little bit about yourself. Let's get to know each other.
Well, at the University of Alberta here, I am a PhD candidate in the Department of History and Classics. And my research is focused on the history of residential schools in Inuvik, Northwest Territories, between the years of 1959 and when the last residential school closed their Grolier Hall in 1996. And this is kind of a family history for me. I've had some family members who went to residential schools and have also felt the intergenerational effects of that.
So now, getting to you a little bit more, what does Indigenous feminism mean to you?
Wow. Well, I could talk about feminism all day. Indigenous feminism actually has a lot of meanings. I think back to our history as Gwich'in people. We had very strong women who led our communities as political leaders. Also, our societies were pretty flexible as far as gender and sexuality went. We were a matrilineal society. Mm-hmm. Lots of cases of women having several husbands and vice versa. Very flexible social rules. But for being an Indigenous feminist today, I think that we have to try and unpack it more, add a little bit more nuance. So even though in Indigenous cultures, you know, we do want to make ample space for fluid relations and two-spirited people, we also have to understand that a lot of things are intersectional. So the way that we think about race and class and gender and ableism, in order to be a good feminist, so to say, I think that we have to be supportive of all those things.
Okay, that's really cool. How are residential schools a feminist issue?
I mean, for sure, residential schools are a feminist issue. Like, one of the things that I think about feminism is that we really want everyone to be treated according to what they deserve, right? Like, I mean, when I talk about intersectional feminism, race is certainly one of those factors.
Yes.
And I mean, one interesting thing actually about Grolier and Stringer Hall is that even though they were residential schools, there were a few white children who resided there. That being said, they would have also been affected by hostile policies.
Yes.
However, the whole system was not designed for their elimination. So, I mean, if you think about how the Canadian nation state was constructed and then expanded into the north, Indigenous women have kind of always centrally been one of the main threats. They were kind of, you know, constructed as bad mothers, unable to look after their children. And then you get other social factors into the mix, like alcohol, you know.
That really didn't exist before.
Exactly. All kinds of new factors that we were expected to cope with. And especially in Inuvik, it was this grand plan of trying to move families off the land and into town. And for the first time ever, you have a liquor store that I'll say is owned by the territorial government. And so that caused a lot of problems. And I mean, I think one of the unique aspects about the Northwest Territories is, you know, the last school closed like 20 years ago, 21 years ago.
Which is not that long ago.
No, and it's still it's still pretty fresh.
Yeah.
It's still pretty fresh up there. On the other hand, there's a ton of like language revitalization programs, on the land programs. I mean, I think the other aspect that certainly would come into play for feminists is that former residential school students and survivors and their families are still coping with a lot of trauma. And a lot of that trauma we are now seeing with social services and the removal of children from their families. Certainly, Cindy Blackstock and others have suggested that this is a new form of obviously removing children from their families.
Yeah. How does your research tie into and consider feminism?
I'm actually working on one chapter right now that looks at Indigenous bodies at Grolier and Stringer Hall. So, like, how bodies were kind of wrapped up in the colonial framework of assimilation. And specifically about women, like, these are residential schools that were open throughout the 1960s, the 1970s, so not that long ago. And women at these institutions had to have forced monthly pelvic examinations. There was, at Grolier Hall, a giant chart on the wall that tracked everyone's menstrual cycle, like, for everyone to see. You had to ask for pads. You weren't even allowed to use tampons.
I wonder why all of those arbitrary rules were enforced.
Well, I mean, I think it was for, you know, basically the federal government and colonizers to... you know, gain control over someone that they thought was pretty dangerous, Indigenous women, right? We were threatening their project of expanding the Canadian nation state. So, so some very interesting material. Lots of programs like around venereal disease. And then, of course, in my research, I get into, you know, sexual assaults and stuff like that that happen both at the residential school, but then also just more broadly in Inuvik.
I know, like, in the South, we hear about, because it was a boarding school, there were really high sexual assault rates. Is it the same in Inuvik?
I would say even more so.
Okay.
Because Grolier Hall had close to 400 cases that were brought forward in the early 1990s. And the RCMP basically interviewed everyone and then whittled it down to 23 because they really felt that those 23 cases could win in court.
Did they end up getting to the court phase?
They did,
And most, like, of them win?
Probably half a dozen people have been charged and sent to prison. But there was also a Grolier Hall legal case. And that was negotiated with the Roman Catholic Church, but also the Canadian government. And that Grolier Hall case actually set the framework for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Yeah. That's cool.
It is.
I would have never guessed that. What motivated you to get started with your research?
You know, I kind of have this long story that I will shorten for our purposes. Basically, came to university at kind of a late age. You know, I didn't really finish high school till I was 23 or 24. And I just came to university with a blank slate and wanting a new start. And actually found a really great mentor in history. And I just thought, well, let's give this a shot. And as I wrote my MA thesis, you know, I knew that as someone from the North, as someone who is Gwich'in, that I just really felt like I had a contribution that I could make. And so I mean, like, it's all kind of about reciprocal relationships and about giving back. And, you know, as someone who is Gwich'in living in the Edmonton area, you know, I can't practice my culture every single day. There are things I can do, but I can't do everything.
It's hard to be active in a community that you don't live in.
So I kind of feel like that I make my own contribution back to our culture through my research.
Now, turning this onto another page, what were some pre-colonial constructs of womanhood?
Like, of course, I know about Gwich'in best. And we have a number of historical accounts and stories and legends about women.
Yeah.
So specifically, we have practices around our moon time and menstruating.
Okay.
And we hold like a certain kind of power once we start to do that.
Yes.
And there's actually a pretty famous story of a little girl who was walking down the beach, and she was wearing a hood so she wouldn't look at her father or her brother as they went off on their hunt. And she accidentally did, and they turned to stone.
Okay.
So very powerful representation of what we can do, I suppose.
Yeah, it shows our strength. How did residential schools affect this conception of womanhood?
Residential schools and Christianity and colonialism kind of all go together.
Yeah.
So, you know, when our ancestors converted to Christianity, you know, about a century ago, all kinds of conceptions like around polygamy, all of that would have been no longer okay, like to have several husbands or wives. Mm-hmm. Also more of a patriarchal kind of
society.
So, yeah, like social relations would have emerged from that.
Yes.
And I mean, I think it just in general, the like the partnership among families also would have changed.
Okay.
Because now you have families who are going into so-called organized communities for like Christmas and Easter.
Okay.
And like certain hunting and trapping periods would kind of be planned around that.
Okay.
Yeah. So those are just a couple examples.
So it just changed like kind of how the family existed.
Yes.
Did you say, yeah?
They were also taught to be straight.
Okay.
You know, so no two-spiritedness, you know, LGBTQ, none of that would have been tolerated. You know, meanwhile, a lot of these kids are being traumatized and assaulted. So not really learning what a healthy, intimate relationship is in the first place.
Yeah. About the two-spirited thing, was that, like, so I know that it's, like, really popular amongst plenty of Indigenous cultures because we're just very welcoming, but, like, more specifically, the gender binaries that, like, surround it, so, like, girls having to wear skirts and boys having to, like, cover up their tattoos, was that, did that change before and after residential schools?
Yeah, I think it did, like, specifically for the Gwich'in, and this is probably noteworthy, is that I've never read anywhere for us to refer to people as two-spirits.
Okay.
So I think that that's maybe like a pan-Indigenous word that is kind of applied to us.
Okay.
So I'm not sure what it would have been called for Gwich'in. Like, I think flexibility was just kind of worked into our culture.
Yeah.
And that way it would have been so normalized that maybe we wouldn't have really called it anything.
They would have just been people to us instead of people who have to
do it,
identify as a certain way.
Exactly.
Okay.
I think really with the introduction of Christian society and missionaries, like specifically in our region, that would have been about the 1870s, 1880s.
Yeah.
You know, you see women like my grandmother, Marka Bullock.
Yeah.
Now wearing a headscarf.
Yes.
Wearing long dresses.
Okay.
Dressing pretty modestly. Mm-hmm. And actually, if you go back and look at early, like, artistic renditions of Gwich'in women, we weren't dressed that way.
How were we dressed?
Mostly in skins and hides and stuff like that. But there wasn't really anything especially modest about it. We didn't have to wear head coverings.
Yeah.
We had these gorgeous facial tattoos, which I totally want to get one day. certainly in our own region, I kind of see this resurgence of womanhood happening right now. For instance, like we elected the first president of the Gwich'in Tribal Council, who is a woman. That was really awesome. We have all kinds of leaders, especially in education. You know, Velma Lisiak, she's the principal of the school in Iqaluit. We have an education superintendent in Inuvik who's Gwich'in. You know, Alistine Andre, who is retiring this fall. She's an anthropologist with the Gwich'in Tribal Council. And so I really see, like, all of these great things happening. However, I do still see, like, some women feeling that maybe the home is still kind of their place to be. I would say, I'm using air quotes here, like traditional gender roles. But those are like traditional white people gender roles. Right? For the woman to stay home and cook and clean. So when I say traditional here, I'm not referring to like our indigenous
traditions.
That's right.
So what were traditional expressions? Not, I guess not expressions. Like what were the traditional gender roles in indigenous societies?
Well, from all of the reading that I've been doing, they call it a partnership. So, I mean, as I mentioned, you might have a family with like several wives or several husbands, many, many children, lots of children.
We love children.
And basically what would happen is when you're traveling out on the land, especially in the winter, when you're traveling by dog team, when you're packing a sled, you would travel with other families in in groups into the mountains in order to find the caribou and stuff. There's a great document called The Cope Stories. And these were interviews that a lot of our family members undertook throughout the 1970s and 80s. And those memories are kind of cataloged in there. But yeah, I would say it was a partnership that it was, you know, egalitarian. Of course, men had certain jobs, women had certain jobs.
It wasn't like super strict, like only women could put the berries in this. It was very fluid.
It was very fluid and free. And I mean, once we start to get into the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, where, you know, we're learning the ways of Unjit, of white people. That, you know, kind of these gender confines are being placed over us. But you talk to a lot of people and some of them were lucky to stay home from residential school. And I have a cousin, for instance, he stayed home. And his siblings were off at school and he was a boy, but because he was the only child at home, he learned how to sew. He learned how to bake. He learned how to bead. He delivered babies, right? So you kind of just step in wherever you're needed. However, I will say that, like, when we do talk about our own cultures, it especially in the context of colonization, we also need to be aware that, you know, historically we weren't perfect.
Well, thank you so much, Crystal. This has been great.
Yeah.
Lovely learning about Indigenous feminism and residential schools and how they all tie in together.
Masi Cho, thank you so much for inviting me.
I would say in closing this project, I learned a lot about feminism. Both of them kind of articulated and encapsulated the nuances that I had associated with feminism previously, but were challenged by my teacher telling me that feminism didn't exist. I wanted something with more nuance. I wanted something that challenged hegemonic narratives, that challenged settler sexualities, that challenged settler colonialism, while still maintaining true to its roots and its core. And I found that was my experience with this radio documentary and this exploration into Indigenous feminism. And I hope that it was beneficial for you and your own personal research. I'm Autumn Schnell, and thank you for listening to Indigenous Feminisms.
You just heard a documentary from Carving Space, an Indigenous radio doc series.
If you like what you heard, feel free to visit citr.ca for more info.
Or tune in every Monday at 11 a.m. until May 14th for Docs in the Series. I'm Rachel Lau.
And I'm Autumn Schnell. Thank you for listening.
Daze.
Masicho.